right away, a lot of people were talking about how can we make sure that the paper continues.
The Cordova Times finds a buyer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Permanent Fund wraps up a banner year.
The entire fund had a 20.6% return, which is the third highest in the fund's history.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Check the status of your application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for placing half in a college savings account and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
A congressional aide to Lisa Murkowski has agreed to a plea deal that has him serving 10 months in prison for a fishing violation while he was a member of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. KTOO's Matt Miller reports.
Arnie Fugelvog submitted his resignation Sunday as fisheries aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski. In a statement, Murkowski thanked Fugelvog for his years of service and said he has cooperated fully with the authorities, taken responsibility for his actions, and accepted the consequences. On Monday, federal prosecutors filed a single charge of violating the Lacey Act against Fugelvog and announced a plea deal that had been in the works since at least last April. According to court documents, prosecutors say Fugelvog falsely reported locations of his sablefish catches between 2001 and 2006. From 2003 until he was hired by Senator Murkowski in 2006, Fugelvog also served on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council that's responsible for managing sablefish and other species in federal waters off of Alaska. According to court documents, prosecutors single out the 2005 season in which Fugelvog allegedly caught twice his quota of sablefish in the western Yakutat area. He allegedly covered up his illegal fishing by falsely claiming that the other half of the catch, about 30,000 pounds, was caught in the central Gulf. Fugelvog was charged with violating the Lacey Act because the fish, valued at $100,000, was transported as part of interstate commerce. He's expected to plead guilty during arraignment next Tuesday in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. He declined to comment Tuesday. Prosecutors have declined to comment until after the court hearing. As outlined in the plea agreement, the possible sentence includes a $50,000 fine in addition to 10 months in prison. He must also pay $100,000 to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation for enhancing fish habitat along the Gulf of Alaska coast. He must also have an announcement acknowledging his wrongdoing published in National Fisherman magazine. Fugelvog grew up fishing in Petersburg and was named Highliner of the Year by National Fisherman magazine in 2003. He also worked as president of the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association and served on the council's advisory panel before his appointment as a full member. He was also a candidate to head up the National Marine Fisheries Service but withdrew from consideration in 2009. With help from Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, I'm Matt Miller reporting in Juneau.
Congress may have sorted out a plan to raise the debt limit this week, but it's leaving town with the Federal Aviation Administration in partial shutdown mode for the next month. A dispute over rural air service and airline workers' ability to unionize stopped Congress more than 10 days ago from passing a bill to keep the FAA fully operating. That caused the agency to temporarily lay off 4,000 FAA employees nationwide, including 79 in Alaska. They're out of work until the deal is reached. And the Senate and House both recessed today for the month without resolving the situation. The partial shutdown has also halted airport construction projects and is costing $30 million per day in uncollected airline ticket taxes, far more than the amount of money the original dispute is over. Alaska's congressional delegation implored leadership to get something passed. Senator Lisa Murkowski says members should not leave until a deal is reached.
That needs to be resolved. It simply does. Whether it's the 79 Alaskans that have been furloughed or the projects that are literally put on hold, we can't leave with all this hanging. So I know everyone has been fixated on the debt issues, but we can't get out of town until FAA reauthorization is positively dealt with as well.
Either the House or Senate could move forward to break the stalemate, but Senator Mark Begich blames one House member, Congressman John Mica of Florida, head of the Transportation Committee. He got legislation passed through the Republican-led House that cuts rural air service in the lower 48 and sets new union rules for airline workers.
Especially in the peak summer season, making sure our FAA is doing the job they need by doing the construction work that's been scheduled that now will cost more. The revenue stream that goes to the airports to develop and support the industry is not being collected now. I mean, we should, you know, this petty politics is killing and hurting this industry because of one individual.
Senate Democrats have said the House bill is unacceptable, and they instead want a short-term extension of what's already in place to get the FAA running. Congressman Don Young may be a Republican, but he does not like the GOP plan and would not have voted for it. However, he was out of town when the vote happened last month. For now, neither side is capitulating, making it look increasingly likely that the furloughed workers will be out of jobs for a while. Prince William Sound's oldest newspaper isn't going anywhere. The editor of the Cordova Times, Jennifer Gibbons, is buying the paper. The Times is the first newspaper to be purchased after the Chilista Corporation decided to shut down the six papers it owns under its subsidiary, Alaska Newspapers Incorporated. KCHU's Tony Gorman reports.
Cordova Times editor Jennifer Gibbons was shuttling tourists around town when the Chilista Corporation announced it was closing Alaska Newspapers, Inc.
So it was kind of funny. I couldn't really even think about it. But beyond that, my initial thought was that I didn't want to see the paper disappear altogether.
The community shared the same feelings.
A lot of people were concerned. And right away, a lot of people were talking about how can we make sure that the paper continues.
So Gibbons decided to step up. A day after Chilista made the announcement, she went into negotiations to purchase the 97-year-old paper. Gibbons and Chilista announced Tuesday the deal was finalized. The financial details of the agreement were not released. For now, Gibbons says she is glad the paper is staying in Cordova.
This has to be a community-based paper. And so it's going to be dependent upon everybody in the community to participate and figure out how we move forward.
It didn't take long for the community to show its support.
I'm hearing from businesses who say, hey, you know, we want to be there. We want to help. We think that local newspaper is important. And it's not just advertising. We want to be there to help make sure that the paper continues. So hopefully we're going to be able to pull that together and carry on.
Gibbons, who was trying to meet her deadline when the purchase was announced, says her day has been chaotic. After the final paper under A&I is printed, she says she's going to take her first vacation in 8 years. She hopes to develop a business plan when she returns. Gibbons, who has been with the paper for only a year, believes some parts of the business model have to change.
It's certainly online news is where it's at, and using digital and social media. That has to be the core of the paper. And then we'll look at how print can supplement that, because I think there's still a little bit of a need for a print presence in the community.
A&I will print two more editions of the Cordova Times before it transfers ownership to Gibbons at the end of the month. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, procrastinating Kenai dip netters cram before the fishery closes.
Look at how much you got. 15 maybe.
Just yep. Today.
Yes. Yeah. Just know, but last 2 hours.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Alaskans can expect a lower permanent fund dividend this year. Even though the fund had excellent earnings in the fiscal year that just ended, most of those earnings stayed in the fund. The actual yield is based on the income from assets sold and from interest payments, and this year, the yield or realized earnings total less than last year's. Permanent Fund Executive Director Mike Burns told Alaskans on statewide radio this morning that the amount they sent to the Department of Revenue to be divided among all qualified dividend applicants applicants is down.
We sent them last year $858 million for the dividend, and we just yesterday, or maybe Friday, sent over for this year $801 million. So it'll be down 6 or 7%.
Last year's dividend was $1,281. A 6 or 7% decrease would drop that to $1,200. But the final calculation is sure to be less than that because of the increasing number of applications. Still, the growth in the fund's earnings will likely boost future dividends, which are based on a 5-year rolling average. Burns said he was very satisfied with the closing numbers this year.
The entire fund had a 20.6% return, which is the third highest in the fund's history, the highest since 1986.
Over the past few years, the fund has changed the way it calculates the risk of its portfolio of investments. It remains about 50% invested in stocks, but it also has percentage goals for various sorts of risk. But the real reason for its high performance, Burns said, was the fact that the markets are doing well, with even the depressed real estate sector showing growth.
Our stock portfolio was up over 30%. Bonds were up about 5%. Real estate was up 17%. Absolute return was 8%. Our real return mandates, 17%. So, you know, everything was working. I mean, with a strong wind at your back like the market provided this year, it was very attractive for us. And 20.6 this year, almost 12 last year, we're back, you know, we've made up a lot of lost ground that we had during the 08 and 09, you know, debacle. And the fund ended the fiscal year for the first time ever over $40 billion.
The year-end report that from the fund starts a countdown toward payment of the dividend on October 6th. The next step will be an announcement from the Revenue Department of the actual amount of the permanent fund dividend, which usually happens in September. This spring, the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation cut 19 employees in two rounds of layoffs. In part one of this two-part story, KDLG's Daisha Eaton introduced us to a laid-off healthcare worker and got an explanation for the layoffs from the president and CEO of the Bristol Bay Health Corporation. In part two, Eaton takes a look at the impact the layoffs are having on the Bristol Bay region.
The Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation is the largest year-round employer in Dillingham. Alice Ruby is the mayor of the city, population approximately 2,300. She says the BBAHC layoffs are sure to impact the community.
In a community the size of Dillingham especially, every job is critical. Every job lost in the community is important and makes a difference in population in the community and in revenues to the community.
In 1995, the BBAHC became a founding member of the Alaska Tribal Health Compact, which allowed them to enter into a government-to-government contract with the U.S. Congress. This allowed tribes to exercise greater control over funds designated by Congress to provide health care services for Alaska Natives. Chris Mandrigan, the director of the Alaska Area Indian Health Service, says although the IHS provides the single largest source of operating revenue to tribal organizations like the BBAHC, the corporation has complete control of the money, and Mandrigan says he doesn't have concerns over how the funds are being managed.
The Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation has a long-standing history of clean, independent financial audits. Therefore, we have no basis to be concerned about the manner with which they're expending funds that the agency awards to them. The tribal organizations have a great deal of discretion in how they develop their budget.
KDLG requested a copy of the 2010 independent audit of the BBAHC from the BBAHC to try to pinpoint what exactly led to the recent layoffs. The BBAHC denied that request, citing the Indian Self-Determination Act. KDLG also made a request for that document to the Indian Health Service under the Freedom of Information Act. That request was never filled. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says when it was clear the continuing resolutions in Washington would go on for some time, her office called around to health organizations throughout Alaska to see what the impacts would be.
We were told at that time
that everybody figured that they would be able to piece it together. It has now become clear that this piecing together hasn't worked.
As Democratic Senator Mark Begich explains, the health corporations knew there would be delays this year and should have planned accordingly.
Whenever you delay funding, it is fiscally responsible for the people who do receive the funding not to go hire people when they're not sure if government will, in this case, Congress pass the budgets. And we knew there were going to be impacts. I mean, I talked about it.
There's no way of knowing which jobs were cut in which departments, but several former employees say most of the cuts were to direct service providers, and that ticks them off. Don Klein was let go during the time of the layoffs. He alleges he was fired from his position as a counselor in the Behavioral Health Department at BBAHC after 24 years with the corporation because he spoke out against the targeting of direct service providers.
Mostly they've cut people who have worked a lot of years, so they're high on the payroll. And most of the people that they've cut have been people that provide direct service to the clients, which is, of course, their mission.
Klein also alleges that if the BBAHC executive board would have tightened their own belt, they could have saved those direct service providers' jobs.
They've been holding their executive board meetings once a month in Anchorage. It's very expensive. They get a consultant fee of about $350 a day, in addition to room and board and other expenses. So we're looking at a huge amount of money being spent on a meeting that's held in Anchorage when they could have it in Dillingham, but they don't.
And how many board members are there?
12. Just do the math. One meeting is at least $100,000.
I brought Klein's allegations back to Robert Clark, the president and CEO of the BBAHC. In a letter responding to the allegations, he wrote, quote, "There was no targeting of service providers. Cuts were made in many areas over a wide range of salary grades." In reference to the allegations of lavish spending by the executive board on meetings in Anchorage, he wrote that the executive board meets, quote, 10 months of the year. 7 of those meetings are in Dillingham and 3 are in Anchorage for business reasons. Claims of costs up to $100,000 for each meeting are wildly exaggerated. The board conscientiously manages meeting costs. Back at Debbie Coolidge's house in Aleknagik, she's packing up. She says she's ready to move on from the layoffs. She's taking a job with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium in Sitka. She says what worries her isn't the big move she has ahead or the fact that it's too expensive to barge all her stuff to Sitka or that her kids have to start high school in a new city. It's the message that the layoffs send to the next generation of Native people who want to come back home to serve their communities.
I mean, what does that tell the community? That tells every single one of those students, every single one of those young people, why get an education? Because you're not going to have anything here to come home to.
The next allotment of federal funds is scheduled for distribution to tribal health organizations at the beginning of the fiscal year in October. Clark with the BBAHC says if there are further delays or cuts to funding, both of which are likely, there could be more layoffs at the BBAHC. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
An unusually large North Slope wildfire released a massive amount of carbon into the atmosphere. That's the conclusion of research published this week on the 2007 Anaktuvuk River fire, the largest wildfire ever recorded on the North Slope. The tundra blaze burned 256,000 acres, or about 400 square miles, mostly in the month of September. University of Alaska Fairbanks ecologist Sindonia Brett Hart says the character of the lightning-caused fire was also unusual for the normally wet tundra.
It was a very severe fire, 400 fire, because it burned so late in the year that the soil was thawed fairly deeply, the organic matter in the soil, and so it could combust more than usual. So we were very interested to understand how much carbon was actually lost in the fire, how much combustion occurred.
Brett Hart says sediment cores showed no previous evidence of wildfire in the area over the last 5,000 years. Analysis showed the wildfire burned and released carbon stored in dead plant matter accumulated over the previous 50 years. Fellow researcher Michelle Mack of the University of Florida says that's substantial, even when you consider the entire circumpolar Arctic region.
Arctic tundra ecosystems over long periods of time have stored a lot of carbon. And so when we looked at how much carbon was released by the fire, we came up with an estimate of 2.1 teragrams of carbon. And this is the same order of magnitude of the estimate of the annual uptake of carbon by the entire tundra biome.
That means one fire released enough carbon to offset the annual sequestration of the entire Arctic. The individual event is not going to throw the world into climate change doomsday, but if it's indicative of a new norm of warmer, drier, more lightning-prone conditions in the Arctic, Brett Hart says that could trigger the release of vast stores of carbon from frozen soils.
If you got a shift in fire frequency to where you are burning more often in this landscape, you would start to release old carbon. And old carbon is not likely to be replaced by current plant uptake. So, you know, we can replace 30 to 50 years of carbon if there isn't another fire in the next 100 to 200 years. But if we start having fires that are burning more rapidly, then it's not going to be possible to replace that carbon in a sort of reasonable time frame.
Brett Hart says the massive release of long sequestered carbon would be a strong positive feedback to further future warming. The Anaktuvik wildfire research was published in the July 28th issue of Nature. The annual influx of people to the city of Kenai has come to a close. The personal use dip net fishery at the mouth of the Kenai River ended at midnight Sunday. A few people were fishing right up to the deadline. KDLL's Ben Stanton went to the river to find out who they are.
Maybe you remember staying up late at night to finish a big project or a paper that was due the next day, maybe for a class. You know there's nothing more annoying during that time than somebody interrupting and asking, "How's it going?"
Hey, how's it going? I'm from the local public radio station.
That can go for fishing, too, here on the Kenai River North Beach.
Mind if I sat with you for a quick minute?
Well, actually, I want to keep going.
At least for some of the 30 people with nets in the water.
Yeah. Thanks anyway. Good luck.
And some others.
Do you have a quick minute? I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
Oh, that's okay, man. That's okay.
Good luck.
Yeah, he's sharpening a knife anyway. And he only has an hour and a half until midnight, and that means no more fishing for dip netting.
Hey, how's it going?
And now I'm interrupting bathroom breaks, it turns out. This is not going quite that well.
I'm from the local public radio station. Okay, I didn't want to interrupt you.
I've been holding it for like 2 hours.
Yeah, that's all right. I got you, man.
Any pressure to fish or other kinds of pressure, it's probably self-imposed. Anyway, I have no regrets. And all right, Heidi Roebuck from Anchorage is here with her mom.
We're at home today, and we were trying to decide whether we wanted to come, and one of our friends came yesterday and said that there were no fish, but we decided to come anyway, and now we're catching a bunch.
And Roebuck says she hopes they're not still here at midnight, but considering this is her mom's favorite thing to do, it's up to her.
It's kind of hard to get her to stop when she gets started, so... I hope not, because we're going to try to drive home tonight.
Down the beach a little ways, Arnold Zepeda from Wasilla is coming out of the water with a fish.
It was pretty slow earlier. It just now started to pick up.
Just now, with 90 minutes to go.
It was pretty slow. They're finally starting to catch them now, yeah.
But regardless.
We're done for tonight. We're packing up.
Well, maybe there's a little more to do, actually.
My wife is calling me. I'm going to have to go.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. And this is the first time this year that Tim Stoll from Wasilla has come to the dip net fishery, but they've caught a couple.
Yeah, we got down here kind of late.
They could still catch more in an hour and 20 minutes.
That's right. Might get lucky, might get more.
Usually, he says his timing is better.
Last year, we did real good. Of course, we were on a boat. But this year, like I said, we got a late start, so... But we're enjoying it.
So will he catch as many as he wants to?
I doubt it. I don't think we have enough time.
Stoll apparently has no delusions about catching a huge amount of fish.
Well, if we catch about four or five, I think that's pretty good, considering the time. We got down here about 9 o'clock.
Other people that were here a couple weeks back reported catching their limit within a couple hours in some cases. Fish are still coming in now, but not that many. Alaska Department of Fish and Game has revised their estimates for sockeye salmon down to 6 million fish compared with the original 6.7 million. But that's a lot of fish, and even though the dip netting on the Kenai has been open since July 10, people are still in the water now. Not counting me, I'm not fishing, but I have waders on, and I'm keeping my eyes on my watch. There are...
5 people in the water.
5 people.
11:53.
And 7 minutes until the closure. Many people are packing it up for the night. You can hear the big metal dip nets dragged out through the gravel and sand. It's cloudy now and getting a little dark as midnight approaches. And a couple more fish are caught.
Do you know what time it is?
11:57.
Just a couple hardy souls are left.
2 in the water.
Standing still, shifting their feet occasionally.
11:58. 30 seconds.
And now it's down to 1. Will she catch a fish in the next 30 seconds? Well, no. But Betty Skin from Anchorage is positive about it. She and the others with her say, although it's not their limit, they have plenty of fish.
Take a chance and take a last day and look at how much you got. 1, 2, 3, 15 maybe.
Just yep. Today.
Huh? Yes. Yeah. Just no, but last 2 hours.
Oh, really?
Yep.
And Chuck Ross, also from Anchorage, says they were here a couple weeks ago, but it was not the weekend when there was a big push of fish.
Oh, no, we just missed it, of course. It's always, when you get down here, it's like, you should have been here last weekend. That's how it always is, you know?
The second to last person out of the water was Michael Ross from Wasilla. This is his first time dip netting.
All we right. had a hard time finding his waders. Because he's so big, he's like 270, maybe 5'9".
He didn't wear any waders?
He's 5'9 and 270, so we had a hard time finding him waders.
Well, how long were you in the water without waders? What were you wearing instead?
I'm just wearing regular clothes.
Oh, man. How long did that last?
High tide, I was out there for an hour and a half, 2 hours. Oh, yeah, I started getting out when I can't feel my feet anymore. So.
Do it again next year?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Definitely.
And then hopefully this time we'll find big enough waders for him.
And considering how cold the water can be and how quickly time can fly under pressure, that's a good idea. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Stanton on the Kenai River. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.